This is the takeaway for Friday, May 5th, 2017.
The ayes are 217, the nays are 213. The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Sounds from the House floor there. Celebrations for Republicans, because after months of negotiations, Republican on Republican fights, and some nasty conversations with the White House, GOP lawmakers finally got their first job done yesterday on repealing Obamacare. The American Health Care Act is far from finished, though, and Republican cheers were met with this from Democrats. That was the scene on the floor, and outside, this was the scene at the bottom of the House steps right after the vote.
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on 2018!
Taunts of shame in 2018 as Republicans got onto buses to go celebrate with the president over at the White House. Was it a premature celebration? By most standards, yes, because the American Health Care Act now heads to the Senate, where Republicans have less appetite for the Medicaid cuts and the benefit changes and the likely coverage losses envisioned by House conservatives. Here to break down just what's in the bill at this point and what its chances are in the Senate is Sarah Cliff. She's senior policy correspondent at Vox. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now that it's been through all of these deals, what are the big points of what this bill actually does for people's health care?
So I think the biggest point to me is that it would really break down Obamacare's coverage expansion. This is what we learned in the last Congressional Budget Office report. We haven't gotten one yet on the bill they just passed, but the last one gives us a good estimation, and it said that 24 million people will lose health insurance coverage. And that's really the headline to me. A lot of that is through the Medicaid expansion, this program that was part of Obamacare that would end in 2020. A decent amount is also through the private marketplaces. And I think really the thing that is happening at the core of the Republican bill is it is just spending a lot less money on those insurance coverage expansion programs that Obamacare stood up.
I saw one analysis that showed something close to $1 trillion in reduced healthcare spending over the course of 10 years, paired with nearly the same amount of tax cuts for business, for wealthy people, for the healthcare industry, people like that.
Yeah, so you're really seeing a transfer of wealth here. And it was 100% true about Obamacare. It was a transfer of wealth from wealthier people to poorer people in order to get those people with less income health insurance coverage. And in the Republican bill, you're essentially seeing a reversal of that, of a really paring back of these entitlement programs that have either come into existence, like the marketplaces, or been expanded, like Medicaid. And a lot of that goes back to more high-income Americans in the form of getting rid of a lot of the taxes that were created in Obamacare for the exact purpose of expanding coverage.
I want to talk about pre-existing conditions because it's been so contentious, and rightfully so. It's a major issue. There seems to be a great deal of confusion about who with pre-existing conditions is actually affected. This really depends under this bill on whether your state applies for a waiver from pre-existing conditions protections, right? Does anybody right now know if they live in one of those states or what might happen if they have, say, diabetes or they've had cancer already, something like that?
If you're someone with employer-sponsored coverage, which I think right now is about 160 million Americans, you're fine. It doesn't matter if you have diabetes or cancer. That will all stay the same. This would apply to people who are in the individual market who have a break in coverage and then go apply for a new health insurance policy. And like you said, Todd, it'll be in states that apply for waivers. We really don't know, you know, how many states are interested in a waiver, which states. I think it's fair to say more liberal states like California and New York, they're not going to apply for waivers. They like the Affordable Care Act. They want to keep as much of it as possible. But, you know, there's states like Tennessee, for example, a state I was doing some reporting in a few weeks ago. They are really unhappy with Obamacare. They have seen some increases in premiums. They have a small area of the state that has no insurers who want to sell Obamacare. That's the type of state that I could see deciding to apply for one of these waivers. But we don't know at this point. It's kind of one of those big unknowns. And I've seen everything from some analysts who think every state will apply for a waiver to some analysts who think no states will apply for a waiver. So it's really hard to tell right now who would be in that bucket.
And the bottom line also is that a lot of the messaging against this bill, as strong as it's been, which says if you have diabetes, your premiums are going up $5,000, just nobody knows that right now.
Right. It's really hard to tell. And I mean, I think this is something we learned with the Affordable Care Act. When you put all these big policy changes in place, you have unexpected consequences, both good and bad. There's a lot we learned about the Affordable Care Act and insurance markets. You know, to steal a line from Nancy Pelosi, it really was true at a level that we had to actually see the law to see what was in it, what worked, what didn't. And the exact same will be true of the Republican plan. It will kind of require somewhat of a rollout to understand how this affects insurance markets. But I think it is fair to say that this would be a less friendly insurance market to people who are sick, not only because of the changes to how pre-existing conditions are treated, but because there'd be less financial help in the insurance market. Older people could be charged higher premiums. States could also waive out of the essential health benefits package. So there are all these changes that aren't specific to pre-existing conditions, but just generally make this a less good market if you are someone looking for a robust health insurance policy.
Well, let's talk about the Senate then, because House Republicans finished their vote. They went down the steps. They got on buses. They went to the Rose Garden and had a big photo op celebration with the president. I watched them get on those buses. But this deal is far from done. I want to play you Missouri Republican Senator Roy Blunt. I talked to him yesterday, just sort of about how the Senate is viewing this bill and what might happen once it gets there.
Apparently the House bill is popular enough that it got a majority of the votes in the House. So we'll look at it and I'm sure it'll be changed.
I took that, Sarah Cliff, as a very non-committal Republican message on repealing Obamacare. The House has managed to pass it. We're going to look at this thing. We're going to make some big changes, he said.
Right. I think you have a lot of senators who are not super enthused about the bill that the House passed. You know, had Senator Alexander saying that Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee saying we're going to just start from scratch, write our own bill in the Senate. I've heard other senators like Bill Cassidy from Louisiana tell me the same thing. So I think there are a lot of concerns about what is in the bill that the House just passed, and it faces an uphill battle. You know, that being said, I think the Senate also saw the House celebrating, saw the House saying, like, look, we can get this through. They had this victory. And even though the Senate probably is not excited at all to get started on this task, they don't want to be the ones where this fell apart.
A White House celebration over the repeal of Obamacare yesterday before a much more moderate Senate has even gotten hold of this bill. Sarah Cliff, senior policy correspondent at Vox. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Coming from a different world and only being a politician for a short period of time, how am I doing? Am I doing okay? I'm president. Hey, I'm president. Can you believe it, right? I don't know. I thought you needed a little bit more time. They always told me more time, but we didn't.
The House GOP and President Trump projected the optics of outright victory yesterday. Paul Ryan embraced President Trump almost a year to the day of refusing to endorse him during the campaign. But not all Republicans are in that kind of hugging mood. The health care bill and other deals have Trump supporters like former Republican congressman and current radio host Joe Walsh feeling like they're not getting the deal that the dealmaker in chief promised so far in his presidency. Joe Walsh is a former congressman from the 8th Congressional District in Illinois. He's now host of the Joe Walsh program on the radio. And he says that yesterday was the worst possible photo op for Republicans.
I thought it was embarrassing. It's like you kicked a field goal in the first quarter and you have a big rally. You have a big celebration. You have a big tick trip parade. I mean, look, this bill, I believe, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, I think could go a long way toward making Nancy Pelosi speaker again. I think this bill is bad policy. It doesn't repeal Obamacare at all. And I think it's bad politics. I think, look, there's a reason why the Democrats were smiling yesterday and the Republicans were not.
And what is that reason as far as you're concerned, Joe? Really, that the skeleton of Obamacare is in place? I mean, that law, as you know, is polling more popular than it ever was when you were in Congress, and a lot of your fellow Republicans now are skittish about getting rid of it.
Exactly. Therein lies the problem. I got elected 7 years ago screaming that I would repeal Obamacare. For 7 years, Republicans have. The dirty truth is Republicans no longer want to repeal Obamacare. Look, the bottom line is the American people 7 years ago were given another entitlement. It's damn near impossible to take an entitlement away. So what they tried to do, Todd, was cobble together, you know, like three quarters of a loaf of bread instead of the full loaf of bread that Obamacare is. Nobody's going to support that. This was not a bill really that either side of the Republican Party was comfortable with. It's a real mess. And I fear, again, as Obamacare got people like me elected, I feel like this health care bill will get Democrats elected.
When you step back even from the health care bill, Joe, how's the president doing?
You know what? He's not doing well. And see, we're Trump supporters. The problem is we have too many Trump cheerleaders. Look, it's easy to blame Paul Ryan and the Republican Party because, yes, they got rolled. I mean, the Republicans, I think, are in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House. We passed a spending bill this week that the Democrat Party loves. That is a Democrat spending bill. Nancy Pelosi, to her credit, loves it. Chuck Schumer loves it. And it's easy to blame Paul Ryan and the Republicans for that because they did roll. They did cave. But let's be frank. President Trump is supposed to be this unbelievable negotiator. He rolled. A lot of his base is upset. His base will give him a pass right now. But if he doesn't get money for that wall and begin building that wall, Donald Trump is toast.
So what are the listeners of the Joe Walsh program saying to you then? I assume you do call in on your show. I know that you're somebody who's disappointed with Trump so far. Do people have a sense that, oh, my pre-existing conditions, the price is going to go up even more? Donald Trump's a sellout. I don't know what your listeners are saying to you.
It's a mixed bag. So much of my listenership, Todd, still wants to give Donald Trump a real shot. And they, again, they are loath to blame him. It's kind of a weird thing, but in this conservative talk radio business, look, for ratings, the best place to be is to be like a blind Trump cheerleader, because that's what a lot of listeners want to hear. People like a Sean Hannity who say that, you know, Trump can do no wrong. I will say, though, the spending bill was a disappointment to them more so than the health care bill.
So when your callers call in, Joe, they seem to be happy with Donald Trump. They seem to think maybe that these failures are someone else's fault or it takes a long time to change Washington. What's going to be victory for them, 6 months from now?
You're right. It's Paul Ryan's fault. It's Mitch McConnell's fault. It's the Democrats' fault. It's the media's fault. Most of them are loath to blame Trump, though that's changing a little bit. What's going to change it? You know what? Trump needs a good victory. Yesterday in the Rose Garden, that was no victory, man. That was ridiculous. But cut taxes, real tax reform that will help grow the economy. I really think, Todd, that Trump's presidency comes down to that. I believe the Republicans are in trouble, big trouble, because of what they've done this week. I believe the left in this country has woken up like the Tea Party woke up 7 years ago. And it will overtake, I think, the Republicans unless this economy begins to grow. I think that's the key.
Joe Walsh, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, my friend.
Joe Walsh, former congressman from Illinois and host of the Joe Walsh program. France is just days away from electing a new president. The race is down to the final two candidates, the centrist Emmanuel Macron and the far-right Marine Le Pen. There was a fierce debate on Wednesday night, complete with accusations and counter-accusations.
L'épargne des Français,
ce n'est pas cela.
L'épargne des Français est en danger. Alors, à cause de l'Europe.
À cause de votre projet, madame.
À cause de l'Europe.
À cause de...
Now, you don't have to have solid French to know that that was quite a battle on French national television just the other night. It was voters' last look at the two candidates together before voting on Sunday. And the world is watching. Populist nationalist movements from Poland to the United States are vying for power. And France's future in Europe could be at stake here. Even former President Barack Obama has gotten involved in this race. Here to give us a preview in these last hours before voting begins is James McCauley. He's Paris correspondent for The Washington Post. James, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the state of play there going into this final weekend before the polls open?
Well, so today, Friday, is the last day of campaigning, and it comes to a sort of hard stop at the end of the day. And it looks like the debate that you mention correctly as this sort of epic mudslinging contest in a country where political discourse is usually very elevated and policy-oriented has had its effect on the polls. The latest suggests that Macron gained sort of an extra 3 points, putting him around 63, and Le Pen lost a few. So it seems to have had some kind of impact in his favor in the final chapter.
Is there a sense here that France's place in Europe is at stake? And why are French voters experiencing a far-right nationalist versus a centrist candidate who represents no established party that anyone has really dealt with before?
Yeah, I mean, those are all great questions. I mean, I think, first of all, while what you say is correct in the sense that, you know, never in the history of the Fifth Republic established by Charles de Gaulle in 1958 have we seen a face-off between two candidates who do not come from any of the sort of traditional center-left or center-right parties. You know, at the same time, it's really important, I think, to comprehend how what we're seeing now isn't new. There has always been, sort of in the kind of the long durée of French history, the fundamental opposition that we are seeing extremely clearly in this race. And by that I mean you've always had this sort of secular, progressive, legal vision of the French state and sort of the French state of mind that Macron embodies this time versus the, you know, extremely nationalist, conservative, reactionary, kind of anti-revolutionary and anti-Enlightenment version of France that Le Pen has sort of tapped into. While the party affiliations have changed, that sort of fundamental fault line in French history is the same, and it's sort of more pronounced this year than it has been in decades. And I think that that is a very crucial point. I mean, the sort of things that Le Pen says, you know, that goes back to the 19th century with thinkers like Charles Maurras, Maurice Barrès, the nationalists that came out in force in the Dreyfus Affair. I mean, all the way to the Vichy collaboration in the Second World War. I mean, this is really a kind of a red thread that runs back through French history that's sort of come to the fore right now.
So if that's the case with Marine Le Pen, then I wonder if French voters have an acute sense of this moment of nationalist populist politics worldwide. I mean, is that part of the French psyche here?
Well, I think it depends on, you know, which of the French psyches you're talking about. I mean, I think very much so in cities like Paris, where I am based, but, you know, less so in more rural communities across the country. I mean, it's very much the story of the United States in the 2016 election, I think. One thing that is extremely interesting to observe is that, so in 2002, 15 years ago, that is the only time before this election when the National Front qualified for the second and final round of the vote like they did this year. And so in that election, it was Marine Le Pen's father, the convicted Holocaust denier Jean-Marie Le Pen, who made the final round. And that shocked everybody beyond belief to the extent that, you know, approximately 2 million people took to the streets of France to say no. And, you know, everybody sort of came out in droves and voted against Jean-Marie Le Pen that year. I mean, he was crushed. And this year, we're not seeing the same unified opposition to Marine Le Pen. I mean, yes, there have been demonstrations, and yes, she's still trailing in the polls by something of a 20-point difference. But, you know, at the same time, like there has been no sort of epic demonstration against the National Front this time.
So just 2 days to go before voting. And before we let you go, James McCauley, you described something like a 20-point lead in the polls for Emmanuel Macron. You have to ask, after the American experience, how solid is the polling in France? How good is their track record? Can you rely on a 20-point lead?
So first of all, yes. I mean, the polls in France are historically very accurate. And, you know, that's been true for decades, not just true in this particular election. And then, of course, you know, in round one, they predicted with kind of alarming accuracy the result that ended up emerging. So for French polls to be wrong by a margin of 20 points would be really astounding. And you know, we can't forget that, you know, in the final days of the U.S. election, Clinton was never pegged to be this far ahead of then-candidate and now President Trump. So it is slightly a different situation, I would say.
Well, the polls have Emmanuel Macron well ahead of Marine Le Pen. The campaign ends today, a day of silence, and then a day of voting on Sunday in France. James McCauley, Paris correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot, James.
Thanks.
Fake news has taken on kind of a buzzword status these days. Politicians, primarily President Trump, use the phrase a lot to knock down news stories or entire outlets that they don't like. But fake news is a real phenomenon, and it played a role in the election. We're talking here about intentionally fabricated, intentionally amplified propaganda meant to reinforce what you think for politics and often for profit. Now, there isn't that much actual data on who reads fake news and why they read it, but Jeff Green is now in the business of finding that out. He's the founder and CEO of The Trade Desk. They're an internet advertising company, and they were commissioned by CBS to investigate and find out more about the consumers of fake news. Green is also in the business of helping advertisers steer clear of that very fake news. Not only did Green find that consumption of fake news crosses the political aisle, his limited data also reveals that the more you consume fake news, the more likely you are to vote. But first, you have to figure out exactly what fake news looks like.
You know, identifying what is fake news has been extremely difficult. So what we did is we found articles that we knew to be fake news, and then we did what's called lookalike modeling, which is essentially what Amazon does when they're recommending people who bought this product also buy this. So we found the people as well as websites that looked just like those fake news articles that we knew to be fake. And we found from the analysis of that that the people that are viewing those are a little bit different between the left and the right. But on the left, I'll say they're 34 times more likely to be a college graduate. They are 14 times more likely to be in the top 30% of income earners, 4 times more likely to be a C-level executive. They're 54 times more likely to be politically influential. So these are not the uneducated people that I think many people assume are the consumers of fake news.
Right, but these differences that you found are also some of the differences that are embedded between liberals and conservatives, painted broadly.
That is absolutely true, but I'll have to share a couple of the stats from the right. You're 18 times more likely to be in the top 80% of income earners and consume right-wing fake news. It may not surprise you that you're 13 times more likely to be engaged with the military to be on the right, but it may surprise you that those consumers of fake news are 34 times more likely to be reliable mortgage payers. So I think even the caricature on the right isn't accurate.
Okay, so that might be to say it's not just sort of the credulous who are susceptible to fake news. I mean, we already know people have been looking at the effect of facts on our opinions, especially since the election and this fake news phenomenon kind of hit us over the head. And what they found in some of my reading is that it's not really factual information that influences our opinions so much. It's affirmation from people who we think agree with us. And that seems like a big part of this.
Absolutely. There is absolutely no question about it. And it creates these echo chambers. One of the things that our data showed is that once you get in those echo chambers where you're reading fake news from either side, you are exponentially more likely to stay in them. And then the thing that was especially shocking was when we looked at the data on a state-by-state basis and looked according to voting districts, how deep the red is or how deep the blue is, in terms of fake news consumption, is almost identical to how deep the red or blue was in the way they voted. And then it brings you to the sort of psychological question of which comes first in that chicken and egg scenario.
Is there an additional step now for people who want to be responsible news consumers if they suspect something's fake? I mean, it's easy enough to Google more things and check things out. The truth is, Jeff, people don't have that kind of time, and you're suggesting they don't have that kind of inclination. The sugar shot from fake news is too delicious.
Yeah, I do think that there is also some part of us that values truth so immensely that we have to figure out a way to feed that. So if you're reading something and it seems too good to be true, or it's especially validating, and you notice that the URL is something you've never seen before, that's a time to start doing some Google searching. But the thing is, there are so many legitimate news outlets and so many great places to get information that I'm hoping that what happens is that Americans get more discerning. But that's one of the reasons why we as a company are declaring war on fake news. As somebody who is representing the biggest brands and advertisers in the world, we're working really hard to make certain that we don't buy ads from websites that are fake news. I can deploy data, use machines, use algorithms to fight against fake news the same way that they're using them to perpetuate it. And I think by doing that, we also start to get rid of that and reward those things that are great. And when it adds revenue to real journalism, that also will stack the deck in the favor of truth and real journalism.
If I'm a company, Jeff, I might want to use your algorithm that blocks fake news in the future and say, I want you to block true controversial stories. You're going to become a paid internet assassin censor if you do this.
Well, it's all about where you draw the lines, right? And this is something that Facebook has been faced with a lot of allegations about. How did you perpetuate fake news and what is your role? And at times, those big companies like Google and Facebook have said, oh, well, we're simply a marketplace. It's not our job to do that. But by taking that position, you perpetuate fake news. So I could take the position of I'm just a marketplace, but it seems to me that it's not that controversial to draw the line around truth. Our job is to let their voices be heard and to share the message with the people that they want to, so long as they don't break any laws and they don't lie. So fake news just falls in that category of just going too far, which is lying.
So Jeff Green, before we let you go, I mean, you've got a little bit of data here suggesting everyone, not just people on the right, are susceptible to fake news. And I guess what this shows most critically is that if a person like Vladimir Putin next time decided that his best play for disruption was to stir up the left with fake news instead of stirring up the right with fake news and had the means to signal boost it with bots and armies of people on the internet, he could do it to the left just as easily.
I think that's absolutely right. What the authors of fake news do is they look for a political validation, an itch that you want to scratch, and then they feed it with a story. They're just as likely to write fake news about Standing Rock and appeal to the left as they are a congressional plot to bring down Donald Trump from within the right. It's the itch. It's the psychology that they're appealing to. Nothing else.
Jeff Green is founder and CEO of The Trade Desk. They're an internet advertising company who is getting into the business of advising advertisers on what's real and what's fake. Jeff Green, thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the discussion.
Are you crazy?
Are you crazy?
Are you crazy?
Both of you crazy.
Are you crazy?
You can't go crazy.
You're crazy.
Yeah, you want to see crazy? I'll tell you.
What are you crazy?
What are you crazy?
What are you crazy?
Are you mad?
The whole world gone crazy.
You're crazy. I'm a neurotic nut, but you're crazy.
I'm not crazy. Rafer Guzman is here. He's film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway because it's Friday and that's movie day. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Let's start with a political drama. This is Norman, the moderate rise and tragic fall of a New York fixer. Richard Gere and Lior Ashkenazi star in this one.
Thanks for coming down, really. I appreciate it. I really want to talk to you about
something. You're acting
really
like
important.
A maniac. Look what? At you. What, why are you getting involved? This thing is bad for Israel, bad for America, bad for Jews, bad for everybody.
That's right. I want to help.
How can you help? This is a political war going on 7,000 miles from here.
So this Richard Gere plays a guy named Norman Oppenheimer. He's a New York guy. What he does is not exactly clear, but he wants to get himself involved in the world of finance, wheeling, dealing, politics. He does favors. He peddles little influence. He's a small-time guy. He does a favor for an Israeli politician, buys him a nice pair of shoes, a little gift. It's a gamble that pays off later when that politician, played by Lior Ashkenazi, when that politician becomes, lo and behold, Prime Minister of Israel, and all of a sudden, everybody wants to get to know Norman.
So then Richard Gere finds himself far elevated from where he thought he would be. Does it pay off?
It does. It's a really interesting film, and it's got a great cast. Not only is Richard Gere just amazing, so warm and wonderful in this very sympathetic and slightly irritating in a very funny way kind of role, but you've got this great cast. Steve Buscemi plays a rabbi. Michael Sheen plays Norman's nephew. Dan Stevens is in the movie. Josh Charles. And it's a great movie. What really, really anchors it, though, is Richard Gere. It's a great role for him, kind of an unusual role as this sort of hapless, well-intentioned, bumbling young nobody, but really wonderful. I really like this movie a lot.
All right, sounds like a must-see. That's Norman, The Moderate Rise and Tragic Fall of a New York Fixer. Rafer, I was made to watch Guardians of the Galaxy.
Made?
Yesterday. Well, no, I enjoyed it because it was my assignment because Guardians 2 is coming out. I'm going to see it. And my movie mate said, you got to make sure you watch Guardian 1, which I just finished. Let's listen to a clip from Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, and a lot of others.
You know why I did it, Star Munch?
You're not going to answer Star Munch.
I did it because I wanted to. What are we even talking about this for? We just had a little man save us by blowing up 50 ships.
How little?
Like this?
A little one-inch man saved us.
Well, if he got closer, I'm sure he'd be much larger.
Yeah, that's how eyesight works, you stupid raccoon.
Don't call me a raccoon!
I'm sorry. I took it too far. I meant Trash Panda.
The dialogue in Guardians of the Galaxy was hilarious.
Yes.
And the action's pretty good, too. What about Guardians 2?
Well, I think the good news is that a lot of what we loved about the first one is here. Right? You've got Bradley Cooper there as the voice of Rocket Raccoon. Don't call him a raccoon, obviously. Like you said, Dave Bautista is as Drax, my favorite character. So you've got a lot of the interaction, some new characters. In this version, Chris Pratt, who plays Peter Quill, discovers that he thinks he might have found his father, who's played by none other than Kurt Russell. It's always great to see Kurt Russell. The downside for me is that this is too much of what worked in the first film. I think they're going very hard for the comedy, the snarky dialogue, as we just heard. And you remember the big selling point from the first film was the one-hit wonder soundtrack from the 60s and 70s, and they lay it on very hard here, a little bit too much. It's almost the starring role of the film. So, to me, this felt like a little bit of a rehash. It's not terrible. If you're a fan of the first film, I think you'll be happy to see these characters back on screen.
All right, Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Stephen King, Rafer, before we go, people are buzzing because the last gunslinger is a main character in The Dark Tower. Stephen King has a million movies. Does this one measure up to be a hit? What's going on with this teaser?
Well, so we're looking at The Dark Tower, which is a big hit for Stephen King. People love these novels. Idris Elba as the gunslinger, Matthew McConaughey as his nemesis, the Man in Black. I'm a little skeptical about this film. I'm really only seeing those two stars, and I'm not sure why the cast isn't kind of packed with some more star power. You've got an unknown director, Nikolai Arcel, a Danish guy, making his big screen debut. I'm a little concerned about how this movie's going to play out, but the trailer's blowing up, so who knows?
You never know with Stephen King. It could be The Stand. It could be Cat's Eye. Rafer Guzman, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
You know, all too often when we have culture reporter Melissa Locker here, I feel like she's trying to discourage all of us from going outside to enjoy the springtime and the summertime. But Melissa, that's not really your game.
No, that's totally my game. I am what I like to call an avid indoorsman. Never step foot outside. I only watch television, movies, listen to some podcasts. There's no reason to leave the house.
Melissa, you're here with some of the new seasons of your favorite TV shows. I should say that you're culture reporter for Time, for The Guardian, for us here at The Takeaway. You've got Master of None, right? This is Aziz Ansari. I saw the first season of this on Netflix. This is fantastic.
So you're already caught up. All you need to do is tune in on May 12th when the second season premieres. Anyone who watched the show last time will know that he went off to Italy and there was a lot of stuff happening.
Have you really thought this through? What are you going to do for work? You don't speak Japanese or anything.
I don't know. I'll figure something out. Look, I love you, but I want to do this. This is important to me. I don't want to wake up one day and wonder, what would it have been like if I went to Japan? I always play it safe, and I can't do it anymore.
The first season was really kind of devoted to his relationship, and then he decides to go to Italy while she goes to Japan. And the new season is filmed partially in Italy, kind of him going on this, I don't know, mission to find himself in the Italian hills, having a sort of under the Tuscan sun moment, but probably less annoying.
This reminds me a little bit maybe of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon on the trip in Italy. Might have some of that.
There might be some of that in there. It has Eric Wareheim as his kind of buddy going along with him. So I think it's going to be pretty fun, pretty goofy. You know, they won an Emmy last year for comedy writing. So, you know, it's very sharp, very clever, and very, very fun to watch.
That's very sharp and very fun to watch. Something that's a little darker. Let's listen to House of Cards. Season 5 is starting.
That's right. We don't submit to terror. We make the terror.
Jeez, that's I Am the One Who Knocks is the end of season 4 there of House of Cards.
Yeah, I am not 100% sure I am up to this just in the current political climate, like whether I can take really tense political television while I'm already watching tense political action unfolding in Congress. But, you know, in some ways, House of Cards has really laid out everything that we're seeing and gives an interesting angle on politics.
You know, Melissa, everybody on House of Cards is ultra competent and ultra calculating, and they really take a long view. It's nothing like real politics, trust me.
You're the expert.
Now, you love Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. I watched a few episodes of the first season of this. It's absolutely frenetic.
I thought I knew why I came down here.
Rays and rails, baby.
But there's nothing I can say that will unkidnap me or fix my childhood or give you the life you wanted before you had me.
I could have been Whitesnake's Yoko Ono.
And I just have to accept that.
Kimmy Schmidt and her mom there.
Yeah, and so in the new season, she's going off to college, and, you know, it's a very exciting world for someone, and John Hamm is coming back, and you have to watch anything with John Hamm in it, as well as Carol Kane, who is an absolute legend, and the show has really clever writing, it has, you know, Tina Fey involvement, and how can you not just kind of fall in love with it?
Now, here's where I want to end. There is a new show that's a throwback. Twin Peaks was an absolute hit back in, I don't even know, the 90s at some point, and it's coming back. A lot of people are interested.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that David Lynch and Mark Frost and everybody are coming back together to make the show happen. So much of the original cast is coming back. And growing up in the Pacific Northwest, this show was weirdly familiar and super spooky because, you know, we'd been to the lodge where a lot of this was filmed and the woods around us were, you know, very similar to this. And so watching the show unfurl in front of us was totally terrifying. And I am so excited to go back and watch Kyle MacLachlan and everybody just take us back into that deep, dark, scary world of Twin Peaks. All you have to do is fix yourself a big slice of pie and a good hot cup of coffee, or line up donuts along your coffee table, which is what I plan to do, and to sit down and start watching.
We do encourage you to get outside and enjoy the sunshine, but Melissa is your guide to the great indoors. Melissa Locker, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And President Trump chose the National Day of Prayer designation yesterday to sign a long-awaited executive order promoting free speech and religious liberty, according to the White House. At the heart of this order is the loosening of rules around tax-exempt organizations like churches and religious groups. Those rules prevent them from direct political involvement or from endorsing candidates. Micah Schwartzman is professor of constitutional and First Amendment law at the University of Virginia School of Law, also co-editor of The Rise of Corporate Religious Liberty. Micah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks.
We're going to talk about what this executive order doesn't do, because there were some disappointed people in churches and religious organizations. But what does it do exactly?
The order basically has two parts. The first part tells the Secretary of Treasury, controlling the IRS, that it should not enforce campaign restrictions on religious nonprofits any more than it does enforce those against secular nonprofits. But that doesn't accomplish very much because those kinds of restrictions aren't often enforced against religious nonprofits as it is. Basically, the order is telling the IRS not to do things that it's already not doing. No churches, or almost no churches, are prosecuted or at risk of losing their tax-exempt status under the so-called Johnson Amendment, which is what restricts tax-exempt nonprofits from engaging in campaigns and elections. The second thing that it does is it tells some secretaries of various agencies to consider passing new regulations about the contraception mandate under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that required businesses to fund contraception. But it doesn't tell them what those regulations should include or what they should do. So it's just kicking the can down the road.
Let's listen to President Trump yesterday at the National Prayer event as he was sort of billing why he thought this was an important thing to sign.
As I campaigned across the country, faith leaders explained that they were prevented from speaking their minds because of a 1954 rule known as the Johnson Amendment. I spoke about it a lot. Under this rule, if a pastor, priest, or imam speaks about issues of public or political importance, they are threatened with the loss of their tax-exempt status, a crippling financial punishment.
Now, Micah, you already talked about how these aspects of the Johnson Amendment are rarely enforced, but I have been in many church services on Sunday covering politics where pastors speak of many issues of political importance. They just weren't supposed to endorse specific candidates by name, right?
That's correct. I think the president vastly overstates the reach of the Johnson Amendment. What that amendment does is prohibit nonprofits from endorsing particular political candidates. They can talk about politics and moral issues as much as they like. So there are, I don't think there's any restriction on what ministers and pastors can say from the pulpit on a Sunday morning or what have you. I don't think there are any threats to take away their tax-exempt status for them explaining their moral and political views.
So, Micah, there were a lot of disappointed pastors, churches, political activists from evangelical organizations who were looking for more here. Many of them were looking for political cover if organizations object to Obama-era rules on things like LGBT hiring. Was that even in the purview of the White House in the first place, and why didn't they get it?
There was a leaked version of a memo a few months back which had included provisions that lifted anti-discrimination requirements on federal contractors. That is, under Obama, federal contractors were not permitted to discriminate on religious grounds against LGBT persons. And there was some anticipation among conservative religious groups that this order would address those restrictions. And the order simply didn't. It had nothing to say about equality requirements for LGBT persons in federal contracting. Just wasn't in there. And so a lot of people were disappointed about the scope of the executive order.
So if the executive order itself didn't go as far as many religious organizations would have wanted, it seems as though most of these fights are still destined to take place in the courts. There are cases pending now involving religious exemptions from tax laws who qualifies. We saw the Hobby Lobby case. There's a lot more to come, it would seem, at the level of the federal courts and even the Supreme Court.
That's right. There's litigation pending. For example, there's a bill in Mississippi which includes some exemptions for those who don't want to engage in religious ceremonies for LGBT persons. And there's other litigation that we should expect over conscientious objection and religious exemptions. This is not the end of the story by a long way. There'll be a lot more coming in the future.
So those cases will be high profile. They will be important. They will have the teeth of law, certainly, and the teeth of Supreme Court precedent. Before we let you go, Micah, you know, one ACLU lawyer who I read about in the New York Times, there was a lot of alarm about this executive order before it was signed, basically said it was an elaborate photo op with no discernible policy outcome. Do you share that kind of blasé attitude at this point?
That's the consensus view. This order was a dud. It didn't do very much. It didn't tell the IRS to do anything really that it's not already doing. Not much content here.
Do you have a sense of why the White House would issue an empty order at this point?
I mean, I think this was a political show, not much more than that.
A political show and not much more. An empty photo op, says another lawyer from the ACLU. And lots of anxiety, not only from LGBT groups and others, but also consternation from groups on the right, evangelical groups and churches, who don't think they got enough from a free speech and religion protection order from the Trump White House just yesterday. Micah Schwartzman, professor of constitutional and First Amendment law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today as we leave you for the weekend. As we've been reporting, the House GOP's American Health Care Act is not done. It's headed to the Senate now. And it would appear that senators have gotten a pretty clear message from pop culture about how people are feeling about their health coverage.
Would the child born with a congenital heart disease be able to get everything she or he would need in that first year of life? I wanted to pass the Jimmy Kimmel test.
That is Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy talking about the Jimmy Kimmel test on CNN this morning. One late-night TV host's story of his own son's heart surgery and his appeal not to repeal protections for pre-existing conditions. And we've been asking you about your own experiences with pre-existing conditions.
My name is Jacqueline Thomas. I'm calling from Newburgh, Oregon. Yes, I have a pre-existing condition, but more than that, I'm a registered nurse in an internal medicine clinic. Over 90% of my patients have pre-existing conditions, and they are terrified. I care most about them. I will manage. I still have a job that has good insurance. Most of them do not.
Your stories, your experiences with pre-existing conditions as the health care bill, Obamacare replacement takes shape. We always want to hear your voices on our show. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. And you can always visit our website at thetakeaway.org. And of course, we love hearing from you on Twitter at The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.